Football was America's most popular sport by any measure: money, television ratings, fandom, fantasy. The United States is the world's strongest and most vibrant society, and also the only country where gridiron football is the king of sports. Is the popularity of football and the success of the United States somehow related to each other? One of the many intriguing questions explored in Greg Easterbrook's new book, The King of Sports: Football's Impact on America. It's a great pleasure to welcome Greg Easterbrook to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi. Sure, glad to be here, Joe.
What brought you to this subject of specifically football and specifically its impact in this country?
Well, I've written about football. I read a quirky column about it for ESPN for close to 15 years. I played in college. I have a son who played in college. I go to way too many football games. So I thought to myself, what aspect of football has not been the subject of a book? There have been plenty of interesting books about teams and players and coaches and so on. And the aspect is its overall impact on society. It's the biggest sport in the most important country in the world, and there hasn't been a book that assesses the good and bad aspects. There are plenty of both of the sport and tries to put it in a larger social context.
I'm reminded of this every year around Super Bowl time about, really, in the grand scheme of things, of how new this sport is, really, to this country.
Well, traditionally, baseball has been the American national pastime, and I think that started to change, you know, roughly a generation ago, but certainly in the last 20 years, football has skyrocketed by any measure, ratings, money, attendance, and so on. And baseball is still popular, but football has pushed itself to the forefront for sure.
So how has it been able to push itself to that forefront, do you think?
Well, I think I say in The King of Sports that football is the expression of what America is today, both good and bad. I mean, the good is it's exciting, it's a lot of fun. At the same time, it's too expensive, it's too big, it's too superficial. It's exactly what America is today. And you look at the baseball as a pastoral game. It's designed for a hushed period of agrarian quietness. And football is designed for a chaotic, digitized pandemonium. And that's what we have in the United States, so I think that's why we like football.
You make several points in the book which are fascinating, one of them being about its impact on American colleges and universities. And in many cases, what we think of as a great institution has to do with its relationship to football.
Yes, I think it's no coincidence that the big expansion of football began roughly after World War II, which is when the big expansion of public universities began. Remember, 100 years ago, the powerhouse football programs of the world were Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. And now almost all the powerhouses are big public universities. The expansion of the public university system that began under the old GI Bill was a great thing for the United States. Football came along with it because it helped make college campuses exciting places where students of all types, but especially returning war veterans, wanted to be. And I think football still is useful to colleges in that regard. Harvard, Yale, and Princeton still play football, and it's not because they need to promote their people's awareness of them as educational institutions. They play football because they think that's part of what a college is. That part is good. The bad part is the terrible effects that college football has on both on money corruption in college and the fact that only 55% of Division I football players graduate. That's the real scandal of college football.
And what about where college football is played? Because you do talk about how football has aided in the revival of American cities, but it has also helped the communities around these institutions as well.
Sure. I spent, since The King of Sports is so critical of so many things, health problems, subsidies to the NFL, and so on, but I also wanted to have a positive example. So I spent the 2011 season with a Virginia Tech football team. It was a fascinating season, ended in a BCS bowl appearance. And I chose Virginia Tech because they not only win a lot of games, 20 straight years of winning seasons, but also graduate 77% of their players. If 77% of all of football factory players graduated, you and I wouldn't need to have this conversation. But if you think of what Virginia Tech football does for the downstate area of Virginia, Virginia Tech is located in Blacksburg, Virginia, which is a pretty rural, semi-mountainous location. Blacksburg, Virginia becomes the capital of downstate Virginia on Saturday afternoons in the fall. It's a source of great excitement and pride. Lots of good things go on there. There are many colleges all around the country, probably hundreds at this point, whose football teams are a generator of local pride, and that's the good part about them.
Let's get to some of the bad parts. You obviously talk about the exploitation of football players, specifically college football players, and it is not only about the money and the fact that the players aren't paid.
Yes, I think the money is a diversion. People are, because the total cash flowing into college football has gone up so much just in the last 10 years, people think, well, the players should be paid. I don't, although I favor the proposal to add a stipend of $3,000 to $5,000 per player per year so that pay for their books and travel and so on. Every college kid needs that. The trouble with wanting to pay college football players is if there was some kind of free market bargaining system right now, Johnny Manziel of Texas A&M would be getting $10 million a year. All the other guys on the Texas A&M team would be getting nothing, and they would lose their scholarships. No. I've never heard of a pay-the-players formula that doesn't result in a winner-takes-all situation where the stars get a lot of money, and of course the stars are the ones that are going to be rich in the NFL anyway, and average players lose their current positions. So I think that the focus really should be on increasing graduation rates. The boards of directors of big universities, Ohio State, Tennessee, Florida, et cetera, ought to be ashamed of the graduation rates of their Division I players. A college diploma is worth more financially. It adds $1 million to your lifetime earnings, worth more financially than any amount that college football players could conceivably be paid under any system, including distributing all the money to them. The diploma is what's valuable, and the diploma is what they're not getting.
Do you find that there are any programs that are doing it right?
Well, that's why I chose Virginia Tech. As I said, 20 straight winning seasons and a 77% graduation rate. Things are done right there. Stanford, Notre Dame, Boston College, Northwestern, Nebraska, a few of the big deal programs have consistently high graduation rates, but not many. And I say in The King of Sports that one reason that Frank Beamer, for all of his victories and all of his BCS bowl appearances, he's never going to win a national championship, is that Virginia Tech has higher internal standards than most football factory schools do for academics, for personal behavior, and so on. The schools with high internal standards, like the ones that I just mentioned, have never won the BCS title, never will. They'll never win, under the current format at least, they'll never win the expected playoff system that starts in a year because they're up against schools with low standards, and schools with low standards tend to win in college football.
So why can't that be adopted more broadly? You mentioned Frank Beamer here as a guy that's managed to win 258 games without recruiting scandals, a high graduation rate for his players, as you mentioned. So why can't that model be expanded?
I think it can in two ways. One is I describe a lot of things. In the book, I describe a lot of things that are done at Virginia Tech to keep academic awareness high, and I'm not claiming that the players are philosophers or Shakespeare scholars, but they pass their classes and they graduate, and I'll give you a simple example. Every Friday night before a game, they go out to dinner, a fancy dinner at a steakhouse, and the players are called up to get their steaks in their order of GPA. So the players who are doing well in the classroom get to choose their steaks before the stars if the stars aren't doing well. Not only do the players who are doing well in the classroom get to pick first, but by watching the order at which people walk up, everybody on the team knows how everybody else is doing in school. Well, that's a simple thing that any college that was serious about academics and football being combined can do. Beyond that, I think some people have said to me, well, the reason Virginia Tech is in good hands is because Frank Beamer's a decent human being and there aren't that many decent human beings in college football coaching. Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. So let's change the incentive structure. People respond to incentives. Right now, the only incentive, Ohio State, USC, et cetera, the only incentive they have is for victory. So change their incentives. Put graduation rates in college football rankings, and behavior will change overnight.
Greg Easterbrook is the author of The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America. When you think about one of the big headlines to come out of the sport in the past several weeks, of course, is the deal and the ultimate concession having to do with head injuries and concussions in the National Football League. the one thing that I think comes to many people's minds, and is certainly something that you talk about in the book, is ultimately what took them so long.
Well, yes, it sure took them so long. There were first, you know, you dial your brain back 20 or 30 years. There was a macho involved in denying that your head hurt. Oh, I just had my bell rung. You know, it was tough and manly to go back on the field when your head hurt. People now understand that that's not necessarily true. In the NFL's case, there was a great desire not to admit legal liability, which they have not admitted. In the proposed settlement has not yet been accepted by the judge who's supervising the case. Probably she will accept it. It's not an admission of guilt. It's just a money offer to make people go away. So let's suppose that the offer is the correct one. The typical retired NFL player is going to get $50,000-$75,000, something like that. Now look at the high school neurology liability suits that have been settled in the last 2 or 3 years. The typical high school kid is getting $5 million per award because high school kids who injure their heads playing football legally are children. It is a dramatically different situation from a 25-year-old well-paid man who clearly understands that he's assuming risk. It's high school litigation over neurology. It's the time bomb ticking in football. If high schools have to pay million-dollar awards, they're going to stop playing football, or insurers will stop offering them insurance, which is the same thing. And that's a far bigger threat to the future of the sport, but it's a threat to the health of the boys as well. But that's the big future threat to the future of the sport, high school litigation.
The fact that you spent a lot of time in the book talking about the impact on high school players and high school sports, and you use the word mania at one point to describe sort of the industry and business that comes up, that you have 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old kids who are on planes going cross-country to play in games that will be televised nationally.
Yes, one of the chapters is titled, Has Football Become a Cult? And it's about youth and high school play. I personally think that you shouldn't play football until you reach middle school. I think that the pediatric research on that is ironclad, and any parents who are listening to your show wondering whether I should let my boy or maybe even my girl play youth football, don't play youth tackle football. I have two boys, one of whom went on to be an NCAA starter, and I didn't let them play until they were in middle school. I think that's how the approach that every parent should take. But the world does not agree with me. The numbers of youth players are rising all the time. And in high school, the thing that's really insidious about high school is just in the last 10 years, almost all states have gone to allowing year-round high school football. It used to be that you couldn't have practices, conditioning, you couldn't even see the coach between Christmas and August. Just in the last few years, almost all states have begun to allow public high schools to have football events year-round, and that's a form of mania. Obviously, every 16-year-old boy wants to believe that he's going to be an NFL star in the future. That's a heck of a lot more fun than believing he'd better go to the library and study. But only a tiny number of them will ever play in the NFL, and only a small number will ever get a recruiting boost to college. I think the year-round football mania is really harming the futures of American boys, and it's one of the reasons that American boys' outcomes in college, admission to college and diplomas from colleges is going way down while girls is going up, because there's one sport the girls don't play, and it's football.
What is the advantage to the high schools of doing that? I mean, you can see the clear advantage for colleges and universities. What's an advantage for a high school to put that much time, effort, and money into a year-round program, or even a very successful seasonal program?
Well, typically why high school should play sports is an interesting question that's covered in the new Amanda Ripley book. And by the way, I think she's wrong about it. She thinks that high school should not play sports. I think that they should. That's a separate argument to have. But sports should be placed in perspective. From a typical public high school standpoint, the cost of sponsoring a football program is roughly the same whether the program is only traditional August through Christmas program or whether the program goes year-round, because the year-round mandatory stuff that drives me crazy and that is bad for boys' GPA, it's just 7-on-7, which you play in shorts, doesn't require any special equipment. It's just conditioning. It's just meetings and watching film. There's no great cost associated with that to the school. The great cost that's associated with that is the boys' time. Year-round football makes adults feel more important. It allows these private showcases that have proliferated across the landscape. There was no such thing 10 years ago for your listeners. It's common now for boys to spend a lot of time in the winter and spring paying fees so they can go to things that look like the NFL Combine held in Indianapolis every year. They're generally called showcases. They're show-off events. There are hundreds or thousands of boys at them. You're given the impression that it has something to do with being recruited to college. It does not. It's strictly private businesses being run by entrepreneurs. But boys spend huge amounts of time and money, wasting their time and spending their money when they should be in the library or on the debate team or on the drama club or doing extracurriculars to become well-rounded. And this stuff has just taken off in the last 10 years ago. I think it's incredibly cynical on the part of the world of adults to do this to the world of children.
When you think about the culture of football, what are the ingredients of the game that make it something that allows this culture to exist?
Well, it's a macho game, and I like, as far as it goes, I'm totally happy with the fact that it's a macho game because I think it's a wonderful game. But because it's a macho game, it has a quasi-militaristic feeling to it. The coaches are like the generals. The players are like soldiers. You never question orders. At the high school level, especially, not at the college and pro level, we're talking about adults, but at the high school level where the players are children, typical high school 16-year-old boys observe that the football coach can get away with practically anything. The things that teachers would never dream of doing, things that would cause teachers to go to jail, the football coach can get away with. And the boys observe that that even the principal of the school is cowed by the football coach. So there's no chance on earth that any 16-year-old boy on a high school football team who wants to stay on the team and start is ever going to say, "Coach, I have to skip practice today. I have a paper due tomorrow." So the quasi-militarism is part of it. I would guess I'd say that that's the main factor.
One of the things, in going back to concussions that you write, I just want to read a small part of the book because it's something I flagged as being pretty incredible. You talk about one Sunday in November 2012, the National Football League was running a TV commercial in which stars Tom Brady and Ray Lewis, plus Lewis's mother, talked to a medical researcher about how the NFL was devoted to football safety. The commercial ended with Lewis's mother declaring, "Wow, now I feel a lot better about him playing." You write, "Except it was not Lewis's mother. The woman was an actress. This was not disclosed to viewers. The medical researcher, the centerpiece of the commercial, was an actor. His laboratory, a stage set. This was not disclosed. Everything about the commercial was intended to mislead the public," which pretty much sums up the NFL's attitude toward head injuries. How could they be so stupid?
Well, as you observe from the mess in Washington right now, in the modern spin cycle media, the only question is, can I get away with it? And they obviously got away with it. You're hearing about this for the first time. The commercial ran a year ago. My reaction to that commercial was when I called the NFL and said, "I'd like to interview the researcher that you showed in that commercial." And they said, "Well, that's not a researcher. That guy's an actor. The whole thing was phony." It was like they almost boasted about it. The key thing to them was they got away with it, right? They presented something to the public that was intended to deceive, and it worked. I think I would give the NFL some grudging credit for the last 5 years. At least now they acknowledge that there are problems with head injuries. Before, they used to deny it. At least now they've reached a stage of saying the right things, which is more advanced than they were before. But still, the overriding impulse is to deceive the public, and it seems to be working, doesn't it?
One of the most powerful messages for me that it comes out of the book is that you can make the changes that you call for and that you think are very positive without changing the lure of the game by the average fan.
Oh, yeah. The final chapter of The King of Sports is a package of, I think, very practical and doable reforms. The goal being, as I write, to keep football just as exciting and popular, but no longer notorious. I think if you didn't let kids below middle school age play tackle football. They could play flag football, which is a lot of fun. And guess what Peyton Manning and Eli Manning did until middle school? They played flag football.
Right.
Peyton Manning did not put on pads until he went to middle school because his father was a former NFL player who knew the data and knew the studies and didn't let his kids go out and injure their heads when their heads weren't mature enough to take the pounding yet. So you don't let kids play tackle football until they get to middle school. In high school, you dial football back to a seasonal sport so boys have time to do their other studies and become well-rounded. In college, you put a big emphasis on graduation rates, penalize schools that don't have the right graduation rates, and you also offer players six-year scholarships so that when their average 4.5 years of athletic eligibility is expired, then they have three semesters to repair their credits and graduate. And at the pro level, you take away all public subsidies and tax favors to the extremely profitable NFL. It's really offensive that this profitable organization is subsidized by the public. You do that package of things, and football is just as exciting, just as popular. It's not a negative social influence anymore.
It's a fascinating book. It's The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books from St. Martin's Press. Greg Easterbrook, it's always wonderful to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
And thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America. It is published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.